Support for news comes from the Orfala Foundation, working to strengthen communities by empowering individuals at orfalafoundation.org.
This is the Daily Circuit. I'm Carrie Miller along with Tom Weber. Today on the show, the latest on the tornadoes in Moore, Oklahoma, including the science of F4 and F5 tornadoes. We're also going to talk about why millennial voters aren't the sure thing the Democrats think they are. I'll be welcoming what you have to say about that. We'll open up the phone lines.
And Carrie, the president will be speaking here in a moment or so on this tornado, and we'll bring you some sound from what he said later this hour as well. In regional news, leading the story, of course, is that midnight deadline that lawmakers reached last night to pass a budget. One of the things they did not finalize was legislation to increase Minnesota's minimum wage. House and Senate DFLers could not reach agreement on a new base wage. House DFLers wanted $9.50 an hour. Senate Dems wanted $7.75. The current state minimum wage is $6.15, but most workers earn the higher federal minimum wage. DFO Representative Ryan Winkler says he's disappointed that Senate DFLers wouldn't go higher, but he'll keep pushing for an increase next year.
We're talking about a pay increase for 350,000 Minnesota workers that would help the economy and make a big difference in their lives. And if the people who say that they're Democrats aren't willing to do that, then I question whether they're being honest about their own values.
DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach says he does expect a wage hike to pass next year. The Nature Conservancy and nearly two dozen other habitat and sportsmen's groups want Governor Dayton to veto part of the legacy bill that passed yesterday. That funding bill includes two projects that were not recommended by a council tasked with making such recommendations. One is for habitat restoration in metro area parks. The other is for an aquatic invasive species grant program. David Hartwell chairs that Outdoor Heritage Council and says giving those projects money would set a bad precedent.
And I completely understand that the legislature has the final say on this money, but this should be something that is allocated based on a process, a demonstrated need, a good use of taxpayer dollars, and not based on a lobbying effort, not based on a please put it in my backyard type of mentality.
Metro area parks have complained about the small percentage of outdoors money being spent in the metro area. Richfield-based Best Buy posted an $81 million first quarter net loss this morning as the company lowered prices to compete with online rivals. If you exclude restructuring and some other charges, the company actually exceeded Wall Street expectations, but Best Buy warned that continued price competition could squeeze profits in coming months. A new study shows climate change could mean better conditions for some Lake Superior fish species, but worse for others. Dan Crocker has more.
Lake Superior surface water temperatures increased by about 4.5 degrees Fahrenheit between 1979 and 2006. That's one of the fastest rates of any lake on Earth. This new study from researchers at the University of Wisconsin shows that warming has created more suitable habitat in the lake for some fish, like Chinook salmon, walleye, and lean lake trout, but less favorable conditions for Siskiwit lake trout, a fatty fish that thrives in cold water. Scientists mapped changes in Lake Superior water temperatures and matched that to the temperatures preferred by the four fish species. They say the temperature changes don't necessarily mean fewer Siskiwit will live in the lake in the future, but they do expect to see changes in the lake's food web as climate change proceeds. The study was published in PLOS One, a journal of the Public Library of Science. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And Carrie, that is the latest regional news here on the Daily Circuit. Worth noting, though, the president is making a statement right now about the Oklahoma tornado. We'll bring that a part of that later this hour.
Thank you, Tom. Now, in depth on what millennials want. President Obama scored big among them in the last election. He won voters 18 to 29 years old by 23 points. But new polling emphasizes the disillusionment of young voters and suggests that Republicans may have more opportunity there than Democrats think. In a recent national poll, young voters gave the president a 46% approval rating, disapproval rating, I should say. And when you zero in on specific issues, the disapproval number goes even higher. Political wise man Charlie Cook recently wrote in the National Journal, "Millennial cynicism about leaders is high and getting higher." And Cook means leaders from both parties. So as our guests join us, I'm looking for the benefit of your experience as well and your perspective on this. If you're between 18 and your early 30s, Tell me about your perception of the president's handling on specific issues. How well has he done on gun violence, let's say? How about the economy and the deficit? What about environmental issues? Specifically asking to hear this morning from younger voters, those millennial voters between 18 and, let's say, your early 30s. Talk to me today about where you think the president has been on environmental issues, gun violence, the economy, and the deficit. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You go to the Daily Circuit page and click on the Hour Show to comment, and you can reach me on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Trey Grayson is director of Harvard's Institute of Politics, and he's with us today from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Trey. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Glad to be back on, Carrie.
Kristen Soltis Anderson is with us, VP of the Winston Group. It's a Republican research and communication firm, and she's with us today from Washington. Hi, Kristen. Good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
Hey, Kristen, I find this idea really interesting because it has been such an article of faith that young voters support Democrats and that the way things are headed, that they will be supporting Democrats for a long time. And yet, then I remember those young voters who were showing up at Ron Paul rallies. Talk to me about where you think the opportunity is and the challenges for Republicans and maybe even some of these libertarian candidates.
So you're right that there's been this article of faith that young voters are sort of always a Democratic constituency. And if you look at the data, that's not necessarily the case. Back in 2000, people are sometimes surprised when I point out that George W. Bush did about as well among young voters as he did among seniors in that election. This whole idea that age and voting behavior are strongly correlated and that Democrats are always winning young people is simply not the case. Unfortunately for Republicans, in these last two elections, they've lost young voters by such huge margins, and young voters have such a negative view of the Republican Party. There's a risk that there will be this sort of long-term effect where this generation of millennials will constantly, for the rest of their lifetime as a voter, will have this negative sort of sour taste in their mouth about the Republican Party.
Kristen, let me just interject here, because one of the things we know is that your voting patterns get solidified often at that age, right? The way you vote at that age is often the way you may continue voting.
You're right. The things that happen when you first come of age politically, they do sort of echo through your life as a voter. It's not to say you can't change party, but it does have a significant effect. I think it was Gallup that found that people who came of political age during the 80s when Reagan was president still to this day are more likely to be Republican than both those who are older and younger than them. So there are strong effects that get felt throughout time. What Republicans need to do is focus on the issues where they and the millennial generation have a lot of agreement. And for the most part, that's more economic and particularly fiscal issues.
So, Trey, this negative perception that young voters have of Republicans, would you say that is individual issues and stands, or would you say it's something overall about the party?
Probably a little bit of both. In our survey, which we look at 18 to 29-year-olds, and as when you were soliciting callers, obviously millennials are a little bit bigger than that demographic, but for polling purposes, that's the group we look at. They do have a lower approval rating of Republicans in Congress than Democrats in Congress, although there was a slight uptick in this particular survey. And if you look at certain issues, it's hit or miss. I mean, we often ask them about economic issues or policies to get the country moving again. And these millennials in our surveys seem to be more supportive of, for example, tax cuts than spending increases to get the economy moving again. And so, as Kristen said, there is a sort of libertarian element to them. But then on social issues, for example, they're much more supportive of same-sex marriage or just tolerance in general. With gays, lesbians, bisexuals. And so some of these issues, it cuts both ways, I guess.
You know, Trey, I was surprised when you zero in on some of the individual issues, where the president stands on gun control among millennials. And then, you know, a group like perceptions of the NRA seems to be fairly evenly divided. So what did you learn about what millennials were saying about that?
Yeah, for this particular poll, we did a deep dive on gun control issues. Nobody had really done that with millennials before, and obviously it's in the news right now. So we found a couple of things. One is that while overall general public has become more supportive of additional gun control measures in the wake of Newtown, Aurora, Tucson, and everything else, millennials are also more supportive, but not quite as – they haven't moved as far as adults. In other words, they're a little bit more conservative, if you will, on overall gun control measures. On the NRA, it's split. You know, there's a decent number that don't have an opinion, but they're pretty evenly divided on the NRA. And in general, they don't seem to be as supportive as gun control measures. Now, what we don't know is why. We didn't have follow-up questions like that. We haven't done focus groups. You know, our presumption is that it's a combination of maybe it's this libertarian element of this, you know, intersection of it's my constitutional right, don't tell me what to do, with you know, with maybe the practical decision to support these laws. There could be that they're you know, with all the increased violence in video games and movies and things, that there's a little bit more they're a little bit more inured to this, that it's maybe not as traumatic or shocking to them. It's not really clear. It's not a huge difference, but it's definitely different than the population as a whole, and not as supportive, which is really, really fascinating.
Yeah,
I don't know
if
Kristen has any theories on that, because she and I have not talked about this one.
Kristen, I'm going to grab a call here. Hold your thought on that, if you will. I'll come back to you. To Steve in Winona. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going well. How old are you? And you're in your mid-20s or so?
I'm 28.
Okay. So what are your thoughts about this?
Well, I consider myself a young conservative. I was a delegate for the GOP this last caucus.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of trouble voting for the Republicans because they mix up their religion so much with their politics. I mean, people in their 30s, there's a third of people in their 30s are non-religious, and it's just a big problem for our demographic, I think, that the Republican Party seems to be God's party or what have you.
You know, Kristen, thanks so much, Steve. Kristen, I think what Steve is saying seems to track with what we see in polling, right? That Republicans have to moderate views on social issues to win more of these millennials.
Well, it's important to separate out the social issues. So on the issue of, for instance, gay rights, there is a clear divide there. It tracks very, very closely with age, and young people are very strongly supportive of gay rights, things like marriage equality. However, on the issue of abortion, many surveys have shown that actually young people are sort of just as likely to say that they're pro-life as they are pro-choice. And this isn't necessarily for religious reasons, but you have what I've heard referred to as the sonogram effect, where young people nowadays, you know, there's so much more technology to, you know, give someone a window into the womb that young people have different attitudes about perhaps when life begins, and that's not necessarily religiously rooted, and it certainly affects their views on those issues. So it's important when you think about the social issues in young people that you kind of separate them out because the views are different based on the individual issue. On the overall concept of religion and politics, I think the other thing that is important to note is for many young people who their faith is important but they don't necessarily vote with their religion, there's also this element of wanting to care for the poor and social justice. And at this current moment, those issues seem to favor Democrats. So it's very interesting to see how millennials and their religion are affecting their voting behavior.
Trey, I was reading something that Anna Greenberg and Andrew Bauman were writing about this, people that know a lot about polling, in The Atlantic. And they said if Republicans have any hope of appealing to millennials, they're going to be forced to moderate their positions on social issues significantly. They mention, as Kristen did, same-sex marriage, personhood amendments, policies to limit access to contraception. What do you learn about that when you talk to millennials about this?
I think that I would agree with Chris. I agree with actually both the pollsters you cited as well as Kristen on this. I mean, on same-sex marriage, I think absolutely the Republican Party, in order to appeal to this voting bloc, has got to become more moderate, if you will, or more accepting, however you want to describe it. And you see it on college campuses. The young Republicans on college campuses are much more supportive of same-sex marriage and other, other anti-discrimination laws, things like that. So that's got to happen, and it probably is happening a little bit. On abortion, I would concur with Kristen. I mean, our data shows that on abortion, the millennials do seem to be a little bit more pro-life than you might think. But on contraception, I think that's one of the things that the president did so well last year. Contraception is another one. If the party becomes known as the anti-contraception party, or as Alex Castellanos, who's a Republican media consultant, described as the anti-sex party, that's a killer message. Not just for this demographic, you know, obviously women in general, guys too. That's a kind of the 1950s view that's not going to work going forward. But as Kristen's right, you got to have to kind of go issue by issue. And the caller is absolutely right that millennials tend to be less affiliated, even though they may have strong religious beliefs. A lot of them tend to be more independent. Even when they go to church, they're not going to mainline traditional churches. They're going to more non-denominational churches, and it is definitely a factor in how people vote.
Here's Kristen on Twitter who says, I see Democrats and GOP as orange v. orange. In 08, I wanted to believe that Obama equaled change, but it hasn't come to fruition. Same political games. Nick says, debt was needed to curb the economy. Crisis would like to see more on environment. But political realities suck, he says. And here's Kelly, who says, I don't think we're just frustrated with the president, but with the gigantic global mess that we're inheriting. How about you, if you've just tuned in? We're having a conversation this morning about what surveys and analysis tell us about how millennial voters are thinking about President Obama, thinking about some of the biggest issues that confront the country. And we've opened the phone lines, and I want to hear from you. If you're between 18 and, let's say, in your early 30s, what's your sense about how President Obama has handled some of these specific issues? Gun control, the environment, the economy, and the debt, and some of the other issues that you care about. And then overall, tell me, do you feel it? And I think this emerged in some of these recent surveys we're talking about. Overall, do you feel a creeping amount of cynicism about the capability of government to really address these issues? Kristen Soltis Anderson is with us this morning from the Winston Group. It's a Republican research and communication firm. And Trey Grayson is with us from the Harvard's Institute of Politics. I want to hear from you. 800-242-2828, 651-227, 6000. I'm on Twitter, at CarrieMPR, and Steph Curtis taking a look at the Daily Circuit page. Hi, Steph.
Hi. Someone going by GI says, I think the president has been asleep at the switch when it comes to environmental issues. And JQP says, this is the media failing to understand the scope of the distrust. The millennials actually distrust the general structures and operational behaviors of the society they are inheriting.
I want to come back and talk about that. We'll get a look at the latest news, and then we'll pick up what our poster says there on the page. Hi, Tom.
Kerry, President Obama just a few minutes ago concluded his remarks in response to yesterday's tornado near Oklahoma City. He says Oklahoma needs to get help right away in wake of the storm.
In an instant, neighborhoods were destroyed. Dozens of people lost their lives. Many more were injured. And among the victims were young children trying to take shelter in the safest place they knew, their school.
Also this morning, Oklahoma State Medical Examiner's Office has revised the death toll downward to 24 people. That does include 7 children. A spokeswoman says she believes some victims were counted twice in the early chaos of the storm. They'd initially counted 51 people dead. More than 120 have been treated at hospitals, including about 50 children. There is also a chance for more violent weather today, although forecasters say the area at risk does not include Moore, Oklahoma, which was devastated by yesterday's tornado. Hail, powerful winds, and isolated tornadoes are in the forecast for parts of Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma. Los Angeles is about to elect its next mayor, but some residents might not notice. Low turnout is expected today when voters choose between Democrats Eric Garcetti, who's a city councilman, and city controller Wendy Gruel. She could become the first woman to hold the job. They hold similar positions on many policy issues. More coming up here on the Daily Circuit.
Later on All Things Considered, in the session just ended, state lawmakers passed a status quo transportation funding bill. What that means for the backlog of projects, including Southwest LRT. I'm Tom Cran. We'll have that story and all the day's news. Join me starting at 3.
Support for this program comes from the College of St. Scholastica, offering an MBA program in Duluth, St. Cloud, and the Twin Cities. Fall classes start September 3rd. More at go.css.edu/MBA.
Read more about this hour's topics and leave a comment. Click on The Daily Circuit at mprnews.org.
I'm Carrie Miller. Coming up in depth at 11 o'clock, my conversation with Temple Grandin about the neuroscience and autism, the neuroscience of the autistic brain, conversation that we had at the Fitzgerald Theater, and more on the science of monster tornadoes like the one that struck Moore, Oklahoma. But this hour, a conversation about millennials and how they're seeing the progress of the, or lack thereof, of the Obama administration, but also where they stand on some individual and key issues confronting the country. And Steph, I want you to read that comment again, and then we'll pick it up and talk with our guests about it.
Okay, this is what JQP says. The millennials actually distrust the general structures and operational behaviors of the society they are inheriting, from overpaid, low-talent corporate boards and executives to responsibility ducking, agreement-impaired politicians, and the hypocrisy of religions across the globe.
Trey, what do you hear there?
We see that in our survey data. We ask a similar question, and we've done it the last four or five years, about trust levels for various institutions. You know, how often do you trust this particular institution to do the right thing most of the time? And other than the U.S. military, every institution we ask about is below 50%. And in this current poll, most of them dropped 4 to 5 points. So media is 11%, Wall Street 12%, Congress 18%, state government 30%, federal government 22%. These are really bad numbers, and they're not getting better. They're getting a little bit worse, and this is one of the things that's really concerning. If you're looking at millennials, they're coming of political age. As we talked earlier, your political habits are often locked in at when you first get started, but if your trust levels probably are locked in as well, and I don't blame them necessarily. There's not a lot going on necessarily in the world that causes them to trust these institutions, and they're certainly showing it in our surveys. So I think that caller, we don't think he's an anomaly based upon our data.
To the phones to Matt in St. Paul. Matt, is that how you feel as well?
Absolutely. I'm 25, and I've seen it with my friends. People have switched parties, a lot of very engaged people. And I think that in the internet age that we've come up in, we're used to information at our fingertips, and when we see a lack of transparency and just a lack of information coming out from who's supposed to be our leaders, it's very tough for people in our generation to trust.
Kristen, what do you make of that?
I think the data really shows that what he's talking about is something that a lot of young people are feeling. I mean, taking the data from the Harvard Institute of Politics and sort of looking at an even longer time horizon, when they asked that question back in 2003, 10 years ago, you know, do you trust the federal government to do the right thing all the time or, you know, some of the time, it turned out that it was a majority of young people that said yes. And then you fast forward 10 years and it's like it's roughly one out of four. The trust in these institutions has really eroded. I think it's a combination of we had the economic crisis as many of these millennials were just trying to enter the workforce or were just trying to graduate from college and finding that their unemployment rate was really high and it was tough to get work. We're a generation where the older millennials remember September 11th, but pretty much the entire millennial generation remembers the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and those are very defining and have led to a lot of frustration among young people with America's foreign policy and how we've interacted with the rest of the world. And so it's not necessarily a generation that's become a democratic generation. It's a generation that's just sort of frustrated with both parties and wants someone to solve the problems that they face and don't feel like either party is really up to that task.
You know, Kristen, what I find interesting about this, though, is if you talk with millennial citizens, it isn't that they've given up on the idea of the common good and believing that they can have an impact and work for the common good. It's just that it seems to be that they don't think government is in it to work for the common good.
They're very much so the sort of do-it-yourself generation. I mean, this is the generation where you can start a company out of your garage, build it, you know, making cool iPhone apps and, you know, wind up selling that company for tons of money down the road. Or you can go and participate in something like Teach for America, where you're helping kids who need it the most. I mean, this is a generation where we've grown up, you know, volunteering, participating in community organizations. We're a generation of joiners. We love joining clubs and things. And so, and we're joining communities online, you know, getting on Facebook, getting on Twitter, communicating with one another. There's a lot of communication and community action we want to take, but we don't necessarily view the government as a proxy for teamwork. And I think that presents a real opportunity for Republicans who have consistently said, hey, we don't think that the government is very good for solving problems. The question is, how do you then communicate a positive message about how our generation can solve problems and what they want to do to empower that and make that more possible?
Nikki says on Twitter, President Obama's doing the best he can with the Congress he has. Congress is broken, not his policies. I continue to support. And writer guy says the president has done more to polarize government than unite. He ran on uniting the country and instead has split it further. To the phones to Tom in Bloomington. Tom, thanks so much for waiting. What do you want to add here?
Well, the thing, so I'm a 24-year-old. I consider myself a moderate.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that has really disturbed me about Obama is that he ran on a platform of change in his first election,
mm-hmm.
and he's really come off very similar to George W. Bush in his policies on the war on terror and, like, civil liberties. Like, the one specific example is how the White House felt that it could it was within its rights to assassinate a U.S. citizen,
mm-hmm.
Without due process. And I can't remember the name of the specific individual, but that has really, really worried me. And the worst thing about it is that when Obama does sort of push the border on, like, civil liberties when it comes to like incarceration or anything like that, the Democrats that were clamoring and really loud in and that would have said something if it was Bush, aren't saying so much because, you know, it's their guy in office.
Trey, I think Tom is right in that analysis of if you look at key tenets of the war on terror, as the Bush administration called it, you will find a pretty great similarity there between the policies that both presidents have pursued. What do millennial voters tell you about that?
Well, I agree with you, and I think Tom's absolutely right about the president continuing those policies. You know, as I said earlier, the across the board, they tend to be a little bit more focused on their own personal liberties and freedoms, and so they're less supportive of some of these more aggressive anti-terrorism policies, like the Patriot Act and other things like that. And I think this goes a long way. And if Tom's still on, I'd be interested in knowing, you know, what his views are of, you know, Ron Paul and Rand Paul, because it strikes me that that's the chord that those two gentlemen have been able to touch inside, not just inside the Republican Party, but among millennials in general. A lot of their support comes from folks who sound like Tom, who hold those kinds of views.
Let me see if Tom, you still there?
Yeah.
Good. What do you make of the Pauls?
I like them a lot, but it was pretty clear that, like, Ron Paul wasn't really liked enough by the Republican Party to get nominated. They've definitely got some smart ideas when it comes to civil liberties, but as a whole, the country doesn't seem to appreciate a lot of their economic policies, and they think they're a little too crazy. But I like a lot of their stances on things when it comes to civil liberties, for sure.
What do you hear there, Trey?
I think for Ron Paul, I think he kind of nails it. One of the things that prevented him from getting above the level of support that he got, I think, was a combination of disagreement on economic policies, a thought that they can't win. And you see this right now with Senator Paul, and in full disclosure, I ran against Rand Paul in the Kentucky primary for U.S. Senate, in the Republican primary back in 2010. Some listeners may know that, but I just wanted to throw that out there.
Okay, good to know.
But I've been impressed with how he has been trying to address this electability issue, he meaning Rand, head on by running and getting engaged in this presidential race really early. And he's getting some traction and recognizing that he's got to have a belief among supporters that he can actually win a nomination, win an election, and then he can maybe get more broad support, attract more establishment money, endorsements, those sorts of things, the kinds of things you have to do to win a national election. He's trying to tackle that weakness of his father's head on, and so far he's getting some traction.
So, Kristen, what do the rise of the Pauls mean for Republicans, particularly with this generation that we're talking about?
So I think the rise of the Pauls is a good thing for the GOP because it's showing that there are a lot of different voices in the party, and they're going to have this robust debate over the next few years about where the Republican Party goes. And to have a voice that is representing that more libertarian streak, I think, is a very good thing for recruiting more young people to the party.
Okay, but what does it mean for someone like an establishment sector nominee like we had last time with Mitt Romney?
I think it challenges you to have to really be able to defend your positions. you know, the Pauls are, they're, you know, Rand Paul, he's an excellent debater. And the other thing that you have to say about them is they're very authentic. You believe that they believe what they say they believe.
That's
and I
true.
Think, you know, for many young people, that authenticity issue is a reason why Ron Paul resonated so much. I mean, think about it. He's not the youngest guy on that stage.
Yeah,
he's
that's
not
right.
the coolest guy on that stage.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt that he believes the things that he is saying. And I think that's what separates him out from your sort of traditional politician on a debate stage.
Kristen Soltis Anderson is with us. She's VP of the Winston Group. It's a Republican research and communication firm, giving us her thoughts this morning, if you've just tuned in, on where millennial voters are, that group of voters 18 into their early 30s. They're showing up in polls as being pretty cynical about the power of government to really change things. They're showing up as disappointed in many of President Obama's key issues that he ran on and that young voters by and large supported him in, coming up with high disapproval ratings. We're talking about this morning. Trey Grayson is director of Harvard's Institute of Politics, and we're using some of the data that has come up in a recent survey that they've done with that. If you're in that voting age, that voter group, I'm interested in hearing where you're at. Tell me about your perception of the president's handling on issues like the economy and the debt and gun violence and, let's say, immigration and environmental issues. Disappointment, feeling like government is paralyzed in some ways, cynical. Are you among those younger voters who are feeling a creeping amount of cynicism about what government can really get done? 651-227-6000-800-242-2828. You can get to me on Twitter. It's at Carrie, KerriMPR. And Steph, tell me what's going on the Daily Circuit page.
Sarah says, I'm a 31-year-old liberal in Minneapolis. I voted for Obama and still support him. However, I do think he's bungled a few opportunities for action. I think he went into his presidency with a bit too much optimism regarding compromise. And I think it's sad that millennials have given up on the possibility of compromise. I'm still holding out hope that Obama will figure out a way to act on climate change, my number one issue.
Bree says, it's all about the issues. The two-party system is outdated. We want to focus on what really matters. Trey, I wonder if we did a show on this a few weeks ago about party allegiance and well, not in Minnesota, apparently, but in many other parts of the country, this diminishing sense of being allegiant to the party. What do we find among millennials on that?
We do find a similar trend. There's more of them self-identifying as independents. You see it in registration figures across the country, state by state. Even going back to my home state of Kentucky, where we have very strict rules on closed primaries. Basically, if you're a registered independent, you can't vote in the party primaries at all. We've seen a real uptick over the last few years as millennials have come of age of them registering as independents, knowing that means they're not going to have a say in the primaries, and a lot of times that's where the election's decided.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot more, and again, it kind of makes sense where you have on issues. There's not a clear-cut moderate, liberal, conservative dividing line, and we're also seeing them sort of, you know, as we talked about earlier, upset with both political parties, and a desire to say, look, none of these parties represent me. I'm going to register as an independent. I'm going to self-identify more as a moderate. I'm going to go race by race, candidate by candidate.
To the phones to Zach in Minneapolis. Hey, Zach.
Hey, yeah, I think your caller is actually touching on exactly what I wanted to ask. I wanted to get their opinions on what I guess I would call political creep. You know, the parties being, you know, moved so far right or left, depending on how you're looking at it. You know, maybe they're pushing us into this position of seeming cynical because we want something completely different, and we're just disillusioned with the parties. But maybe it's the party's fault, and I think you've been talking about that a little bit. But I just wanted to get their opinions on that, you know. How does that factor into the millennials and the way we perceive politics? You know, at least the right, you know, being a liberal myself, I might be a little bit skewed here, but they seem to have gone so far right that there's nothing I can agree with anymore. And so I might seem issue by issue, but really I'm just being logical in my mind.
Yeah, Kristen, that really does make sense. What looks like cynicism is just frustration that nothing gets done and deciding to work outside the party system.
Well, if you think about it, the labels for either party aren't necessarily great for many millennial voters. I've heard so many people, they say, well, I'm a little bit fiscally conservative. I'm pretty concerned about the debt, but I consider myself more socially liberal. You know, I'm very tolerant and I care about the environment. Right. And that neither of those labels really feels like it fits perfectly well. And that, you know, it's a generation that we can customize our whole existence. I don't have to buy a whole album. I can just pick a few songs on iTunes. You know, I mean, there's the ability to sort of customize your existence is infinite. And so the idea that, well, why can't I customize my political party? Why do I have to be a Republican or Democrat or trust one of these parties to solve things? It's not really there for young people. And so if the parties are the ones running things and you don't feel like either party really has your best interests at heart or you have a home in either party, then that can surely increase your sort of lack of belief that these folks will be able to solve the problems you care about.
And Nick on Twitter says, I'm worried about the state of retirement. Not enough retirement savings for those near the end of their careers is troublesome. We haven't even talked about entitlements here, Trey.
No, it's
there's a whole show, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is interesting, we didn't poll this time, but a couple surveys ago we asked just a generic question about what's the best way to fix Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
And millennials were of the three options we gave them, the top option, and this was not a majority option, but it was the plurality option, was personal accounts for Social Security. Now, that the caveat I'd say is that we haven't engaged as a country in a real thorough debate on entitlement reform.
Right.
So I don't know how informed that particular opinion is. You know, it does sort of fit with some of the libertarian strains that we've seen. But that's just something I throw out there is the Republicans get their votes from sort of old people, and Democrats have been getting more of their votes from these younger voters. And at some point, this dynamic is going to be very interesting with trying to reform entitlements. And when does that reform start? You know, when do we have to start pushing retirement ages back, like that? Millennials are all going to have to be, you know, they're all going to, the Social Security age retirement increase will be fully phased in for millennials. So they're going to all have to work at least a couple years longer just to get Social Security under current law.
I mean, Kristen, when we asked the question, when do we have to start, should have been yesterday, right? I mean, there should have been serious discussion. And yes, I know about the blue ribbon panels and all that, but Washington doesn't seem to have taken up a serious discussion about it.
So this is a perfect example of an issue where you see a huge amount of cynicism among young people because they just assume that they're never going to see a dime of Social Security. I can't tell you the number of focus groups I've done where when these issues come up, everybody just assumes that the programs will be bankrupt, and so they've got to save on their own because there's no way that this is going to get fixed, and it's too big a problem, and we can't even figure it out. We can't even think about it. The challenge is there are so many more immediate problems that young people feel like they're facing. They've got huge amounts of student loan debt. Unemployment is still relatively high, particularly for young people who don't have a college degree. When I sit in these focus groups, they tell me, I'm concerned about if I lose my job, how am I going to be able to afford an individual health care plan, or how am I going to pay back all of this debt? And so, yeah, I know we need to fix those entitlements. I know that we're never going to see Social Security, but I've got to figure out I need solutions to the problems that are right in front of me right now before I can even begin thinking about these battles we're going to fight 20, 30 years down the road.
To the phones to Grant in Bloomington. Hi, Grant. Where do you come at this from?
Well, I teach actually a class in a community college to this age group, and what I'm hearing is a lot of disenchantment, a lot of high expectations and feeling let down. And what they start to talk about is that if they look back in a timeline, that we're relying on these institutions of corporations and government to protect us and defend us and feed us and clothe us and shelter us and give us economic security and solve our social problems. And they just feel that their expectations are either too high or the institutions are simply not working in their interests. And they look back to previous generations and they see that the world now is no longer about the individual, but it's really about the corporations and governments. Mm-hmm. And if they're frustrated with the corporations, they look to government to solve that. If they're frustrated with government, they look to corporations to solve that. They keep going back and forth between these two.
Yeah.
And I think finally they're just getting worn down and they're saying nothing's working. Institutions are not our answer. And that's what I'm beginning to hear sometimes from some of this age group is what I'm perceiving.
And, you know, Grant, I think Liz on Twitter is kind of echoing that. She says we care more about solving problems than who solves them and more about people than upholding any status quo. Trey, what do you make of that?
No, we need more problem solvers in Washington and Congress.
Boy, I mean, amen I think to that.
One of the things that if you're looking for optimism, in these data, in the attitudes, is kind of a combination of some of the things we're talking about, is that millennials are problem solvers, and they're not going to solve problems in the same way as they used to be solved, because what they see is institutions not working. So they're going to go create their own institutions, and they're going to use the internet to connect with people. And you see a lot of nonprofit startups as a way to try to solve problems. And one of the, I mean, I know that Harvard's not exactly representative of this population as a whole, but what's very striking to me are the number of students who want to be social entrepreneurs. And they view themselves as, we're going to go identify a problem and we're going to go solve it. And I'm not going to go wait around for some large, slow, maybe corrupt, maybe not, but just ineffective institution. I'm going to go start my own. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to use my energy, my enthusiasm, and I'm going to convince people to give me money and sign up for to volunteer their time.
Yeah.
And to me, that's kind of the optimistic part of this whole situation.
And Kristen, that's why I was saying it isn't that they don't believe that the common good can be found and worked toward, right? It's that the government isn't in that equation.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's where Republicans have to be careful. Obama and Democrats really sort of effectively painted Republicans as the, you know, you're on your own party. And Republicans really, I think, fed into that in this last election. And that's not at all aligned with what millennials care about, that millennials do care about, you know, helping one another. The distinction is, do they believe that creating a big government program that's going to solve a problem is actually going to solve that problem? Or is it better for an individual to put their own hard work in, to raise some money from friends and to start a company that goes and tries to fix the world, you know, through free enterprise and through, you know, their own individual work. I think that's got to be the shift that needs to take place, and whichever party can understand that, I think, is going to be the one that begins to capture more of the millennial generation's votes at the ballot box.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what does that sound like on the campaign trail? But I think I'm getting a sense of that from the next generation of Republican politicians.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's going to be a tough shift, because right now, you know, the Republican Party is still in this sort of period of transition, and, you know, after having lost, you know, two presidential elections in a row, what's our message going to be? But I think there's a huge amount of opportunity there for young Republican leaders to begin talking about this message of personal freedom, of protecting civil liberties, but at the same time, here's why an individual can start a company, and that can be a really good thing. That business isn't all a bad thing. That free enterprise and the free market can do these really good things and solve these problems. It's a message that I think Republicans need to be focused on a little more if they want to have a shot at winning the millennial generation.
Kristen, really good to have your views today. I'm so glad you could join us. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Kristen Soltis Anderson, VP of the Winston Group. They're a Republican research and communication firm. And Trey, thank you. It's always informative when we hear what you're out there doing with the polling and the views of different voting groups. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to be back with you, and look forward to being on in the future.
Next time. Good. Trey Grayson, director of Harvard's Institute of Politics. From Emily on Twitter, she says, climate change, and I got a lot of tweets about climate change. The pace at which the government addresses it exemplifies the unscientific approach politicians take to solving problems. Steph, what else are you hearing on the page?
Michael says, I'm 26. Millennials are not forever disillusioned with politics, but we need the baby boomers to get out of the way first. We have taken it upon ourselves to make change outside of politics because the boomers in power have no desire to solve the problems they have caused.
And someone tweeting a splendid blog, willing to cross the aisle to support Huntsman if he had gotten the nomination last election, because we believe that he could compromise clearly being important to her. Hey, you can continue to weigh in on this. I'd love to hear what you have to say. Steph will keep the Daily Circuit page open.
Yes,
and
I will.
Taking some comments on that, right?
Yep.
Some insight into the tornadoes out of Oklahoma coming up in just a minute, but latest news now, Tom?
Including the tornado news there. Kerry, President Obama says he's instructing his disaster response team to get tornado victims in Oklahoma everything they need right away. The president calls the devastation that tore through the Oklahoma City suburbs, quote, one of the most destructive tornadoes in history, even though he said the extent of the damage is still unknown. We'll hear more from president's comments this hour in just a moment. A U.S. Senate panel in other news says that Apple is avoiding paying billions of dollars in U.S. taxes by using a cluster of affiliates located outside the U.S. And that panel is questioning its chief executive this morning about these so-called loopholes. Apple's CEO Tim Cook is expected to explain the company's tax strategy to the Senate's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, which released a detailed report yesterday on the company's practices. The world's most valuable company says it is complying with the laws and pays an extraordinary amount in U.S. taxes. Michigan Senator Carl Levin chairs the panel meeting today and says Apple is capitalizing on loopholes in the tax code and is unique among multinational corporations, saying the company is exploiting an absurdity. Visitors to the Jersey Shore this weekend will find many of their favorite beaches and boardwalks ready for the summer thanks to a massive rebuilding effort after Superstorm Sandy. While several neighborhoods remain damaged, all but one of the storm-wrecked boardwalks should be ready for the Memorial Day weekend, and amusement rides will also be available. Most beaches also will be open, despite losing a lot of sand during that storm. More coming up here on the Daily Circuit.
Today's question is supported by Allianz Life Insurance Company of North America, voted by its employees as one of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Business Journal's best places to work for 2012. Allianz, for all that's ahead. Online at allianzlife.com.
The people of Moore should know that their country will remain on the ground, there for them, beside them, as long as it takes. For there are homes and schools to rebuild, businesses and hospitals to reopen, their parents to console, first responders to comfort, and, of course, frightened children who will need our continued love and attention. There are empty spaces where there used to be living rooms and bedrooms and classrooms, and in time we're going to need to refill those spaces with love and laughter and community.
President Obama speaking this morning at the White House after yesterday's tornado in Moore, Oklahoma. Meteorologist Craig Edwards now joins me to look over some of the numbers from that tornado yesterday. Good morning, Craig. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And Kenny Blumenfeld is with us here as well, teaches meteorology at the University of Minnesota as a visiting professor of geography. Good morning, Kenny.
Good morning.
Craig, when you say Moore, Oklahoma, we're talking about this community also hit by a tornado in 99, and when you say on our updraft blog here this morning that it was worse than the 99 storm, we could certainly say it's worse in terms of a death toll or a dollar amount destruction, but how is it worse in a meteorological sense?
Well, that storm in 1999 started well southwest of Oklahoma City, Chickasaw, moved through Bridge Creek, and then moved through the southern portions of Oklahoma City. By the time it was reaching Moore, it was dissipating a little bit. It was going down from an EF5 to an EF4. So I think Moore took, the city of Moore took most of the blow with this tornado, and that's why it looks like, from what I can see from the damage pictures, that it substantially damaged structures that were concrete and steel reinforced, as well as the homes and dwellings that were down there. So to me, just from the photographs, and when I was on the ground in 1999, and I saw considerable damage to the points where trees were reduced to stumps, a lot of rubble, and of course at that time too, we did see vehicles that were blown considerably downwind, maybe as much as several hundred yards.
You noted that you were on this assessment team after that 99 storm in Moore and in Oklahoma there. What exactly were you doing when you were on the ground? What were you looking for so you could maybe conclude something?
Well, we were seeing a couple things. One was the term slight risk used in the severe weather outlooks gave people the presumption that it was only a small risk of severe weather that day. So regrettably, we haven't come very far in changing that terminology. So what we're doing is we were looking to see if people were in tune, going to stay in touch, being proactive in seeking out information. Now, one of the things that was different, this tornado was a little bit earlier in the day. The one in 1999 was about 5 o'clock through about 6:30, so it was really well covered by the media. This one was pretty much in a transition time, people getting in and out of school and going in and out of work. So still were people on the highway. But we were looking to see how well people were prepared and if they did pay attention to warnings. And quite honestly, people were still a little bit apathetic due to tornado warnings in Oklahoma City, mainly because a lot of times the sirens are going off due to these smaller tornadoes. So we learned considerably, and we did write an assessment on that tornado investigation.
Kenny Blumenfeld, I know you study a lot of tornadoes that hit urban and large metro areas. I mean, what are the kinds of things you want to know and you want to learn from what happened yesterday and more?
Well, I think a lot of the things that Craig was discussing, I mean, we definitely want to know. We want to know what kind of precautions people took. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's inconceivable, or at least it had been inconceivable, that the 1999 tornado would actually be sort of thought of as a lesser event than anything. I mean, it was such a disaster, and the fact that we're talking about something that has essentially eclipsed it is quite remarkable. I think, you know, in terms of what people's perceptions were and the precautions they took, it's going to be, I think, really important to understand the extent to which they could have done anything else. I mean, we might be looking at something where this was possibly one of the best imaginable outcomes. I mean, this was a powerful tornado hitting at a bad time and a, you know, continuously populated area. I think another thing that we'll need to know, and this is something that is a personal interest and a professional interest of mine, is you know, are there serious gaps in the system such that certain people do not get the information as readily as others? I think that's sort of the next frontier in the warning infrastructure.
And Kenny, there's a lot of talk about the damage done to the two schools there in Moore, and children were trapped in the school, and some children are among the dead. The other question, though, has to be is, was there a better place in Moore for those kids to be at that time?
That's going to be really hard to know. And, I mean, just from, you know, seeing the video and the footage and seeing some of the pictures and then talking to some folks who were in the area and had some eyewitness accounts, it's hard to imagine when you've got a massive tornado bearing down on you, you don't have a lot of options. And certainly when it's nearby and heading towards you, leaving your shelter for something else is a tremendous risk. So, I mean, there's going to be, I think, a pretty detailed assessment, sort of similar to the one that Craig took part in, and we're going to find out a lot through interviews and talking to the surviving victims and talking to witnesses. We'll find out a lot about the sociology, but right now I think it would be premature to say that the victims could have done anything else.
Craig Edwards, going back to this assessment team that you were on in Moore in 1999, presumably another assessment team will be assembled here for this tornado. Do you look at, is it more of an interview people kind of a study, or do you get into the forensics? I guess what I'm curious about is, do you look at the way the debris is laying outside the school today, and does that help you conclude anything that would be useful going forward in storm prediction?
Good question, because there were multiple assessments going on. The assessment I was on was, how well was the Weather Service prepared to deliver information, and how did that information get delivered, how was it received, and how was the response? And then in the meantime, there was meteorologists. Dr. Chuck Doswell was one of the leaders on that went out and looked at the structural damage to see how the debris had flown through the air, how many hundreds of yards perhaps vehicles traveled. That was coming up with the EF scale. We were more interested in how the warnings were delivered, how they were received, and how the people responded to them. One of the situations that we discovered was the lack of underground shelters, and one of the things we did include in our assessment was that if people rebuild, they should highly consider some storm shelter, which is on the order of about $3,000 to $5,000 at that time when you were going to reconstruct your facility.
So is that a recommendation then, Craig, that you made really simply for that area of the country because of its being known as Tornado Alley, or is that something you would say, for example, that people in Minnesota should think about?
I think it's something that everybody needs to consider, that if your safe shelter is just the interior portion of your house and you have an EF3 tornado or stronger, that may not be sufficient. So one of the people I talked to down in Moore in 1999, it was totally oblivious to the warnings, even though it was headed right toward her house. She had got a call a couple times from her aunt on her voicemail, and she just took shelter in the interior portion of the house. Fortunately, her house was destroyed, but it was near the tail end of the tornado, so she fared fairly well out of that. But if all you have is interior portion of a closet, we really like to have people below ground in a major tornado event.
Kenny Blumenfeld, is there still a perception, and I know that people like Craig have done a lot of work to get rid of this perception, but the idea that tornadoes don't hit highly populated areas, don't hit metro areas?
Yes, and in fact, the sort of combination of perception and, you know, sort of folk science lore is still prevalent. I mean, even last night I was, you know, talking with a different media outlet and was helping them with some of their Facebook chatting afterwards, and a lot of the questions coming in were, I thought tornadoes don't hit this kind of place or that kind of place, or I heard that we were safe because of a city or because of some topographic barrier. That perception is still quite high. Yeah.
Craig Edwards, as now you know these assessment teams are out there, what have you seen in the data about the warning systems, preliminarily speaking? I know this isn't a final conclusion, but were the warnings adequate yesterday?
Well, that's the main question that I was asking on Facebook, is that at what point can a reporter can't go out there and say with certainty that they had no warning? And it looks in this case they had 15 minutes of warning, and my thought at the time was that that is right on the money about what we would like to deliver with a lead time of 15 minutes. That gives people some time to sort of move that information forward. I think what I've seen in the surveys is there's a lot of people that don't have their antennas spinning. By that I mean they're not plugged in, they're not looking for information, they're not paying attention. So if we can pay that information forward and that people are hearing it from multiple sources, 15-minute lead time is sufficient, providing you have a safe shelter. So I think that considering the devastation and considering the intensity of the tornado, that the death count, the toll, it seems to be pretty low, considering people may have been in transit in vehicles and in stores like that and in places where they're not usually prepared to take shelter.
Meteorologist Craig Edwards, thanks for your time. We'll look for more updates on the Updraft blog as well. Thanks.
You're welcome.
And Kenny Blumenfeld from the University of Minnesota, appreciate your time as well.
Thank you very much.
And Tom, at 11 o'clock, we're going to talk with two guests about the science of these monster tornadoes. Mm. What do we know about why a tornado turns into an F4 or an F5? Right. So that's coming up later in the show. This is The Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News.